his Japanese digital recorder on his lap. "I called this meeting to order," said the president, slurring the words only slightly. "Fill in the proper time and date, Hatgal," he told his secretary. The five ministers seated around the table used both their family and given names, a custom adopted from their neighbors. The president, however, stuck with the older Mongol tradition and allowed people to address him only by one name. His secretary followed suit, a small affectation but an annoying one. President Zhamranzjin turned to his Minister of Energy, a lean and bony, dour-faced former engineer. "Oyun," said the president, "I believe you have good news for us, for a change." The others laughed, even the energy minister, all except Lodoy. As minister for the environment, he knew he would have to speak out against energy's recommendations, and that the rest of the inner cabinet would hate him for what he had to say. "Very good news," said Energy. "For a change," he added with a rare smile, "all the results of our test cores and preliminary mining samples confirm that the Altai deposits are enormous. We can be exporting coal to China and the Russian Federation within 2 years."
"The price of coal on the world market is climbing steadily," said the Minister of Commerce.
"Predictions for the next 2 years?" the president asked.
"Coal will increase in value as the price of oil increases, and oil prices are climbing steeply as global oil reserves continue to be depleted."
Lodoy raised his hand to be recognized, but the president instead asked the foreign minister, "Will the Global Economic Council enforce a limit on the price of coal?" The foreign minister, sleek and overweight with greased back hair and manicured fingernails, said smoothly,
"Even if they do, it will be at a higher figure than the world price today."
Lodoy waved his hand this time, but the president continued to ignore him by asking the energy minister to continue his report. Energy went back to extolling the treasures of the new coal deposits that had been discovered. Unable to control his growing anger, Lodoy interrupted,
"What is the sulfur content of this new coal?"
The energy minister stopped in the middle of his presentation, blinked several times. Without turning his face away from the president, he said,
"Sulfur content is about the same as our older coal deposits to the north. In other words," Lodoy snapped, "high sulfur, high pollution."
The former engineer finally turned to face him.
"The sulfur can be removed by scrubbers. If the users go to the expense of installing scrubbers in their power plants..."
"We use scrubbers."
"Yes, and look how much good it does us."
Lodoy angrily waved a hand toward the window. The president glared down the table at his minister for the environment.
"What does it matter to us if those who buy our coal use scrubbers or not? Let them foul their own nests if they want to. It is of no concern to us."
Jumping to his feet, Lodoy pleaded with the older men.
"Don't you see? Can't you understand? It does matter to us. Even with scrubbers, coal burning is turning our city into a cesspool. Cases of asthma, emphysema, tuberculosis, and even lung cancer are rising faster than our medical facilities can handle them."
"That's not true," the foreign minister snapped. "And even if it was, such tales should not be told where foreigners could hear them."
"It's worse than that,"
Lodoy said, inwardly surprised at the pain and sorrow in his voice. He wanted to sound strong. To himself, he sounded like a crying old woman.
"No matter who burns the coal, no matter where it is burned, it adds to the greenhouse effect. It makes the world hotter. Don't you realize that the climate is already changing?"
The foreign minister chuckled.
"Yes, in a few more years we'll be able to grow rice in the Gobi."
"And build seashore resorts with the profits from our coal sales," laughed the Minister of Commerce.
"We've got to stop burning coal," Lodoy insisted. "And oil, too. All the fossil fuels are destroying our global environment. We must stop exporting coal."
"Never," snapped the president. "Our coal exports are a major source of foreign income. With the new Altai deposits, coal revenues will top our income from tourism and all other foreign trade. We cannot afford to stop exporting coal, and we will not do so. Never."
But the greenhouse...
That's a problem for our grandchildren to worry about, said the president. Everyone around the table agreed, except for the one man who understood the problem. You've done a great job of alienating anybody who can help you, Dan told himself as he waited impatiently to get out of the OTV. Jane was sitting stiffly in her seat, looking anywhere but at him. The cramped little spacecraft had finally landed at Alphonsus. Dan could hear through the open hatch of the flight deck the captain going through the landing procedures checklist with the ground crew. The access tunnel had been rolled out and connected to the OTV's airlock hatch. Now they were checking the air pressure and the integrity of the hatch seal. All done remotely, the ground crew remained in the safety of their underground offices and teleoperated the machinery out on the open lunar surface. Check. Air pressure in the green. Cracking the hatch now. The co-pilot slid gracefully down the ladder in the low lunar gravity and went to the hatch built into the side of the passenger deck.
Hold your breath,
she said over her shoulder with a wink. She pulled the hatch open. A puff of air sighed into the spacecraft. It smelled fresh and clean after more than 18 hours in the cramped compartment. Dan had phoned his office the instant the OTV had touched down and made hardwire connections with the Alphonsus spaceport. Now a quartet of worried-looking men stood at the hatch to the terminal as he and Jane made their way through the ribbed plastic of the access tunnel in the stalking, long-striding walk of 1/6 G. The two younger men wore standard lunar garb, single-piece coveralls, color-coded by job specialty. Dan saw that these two wore the policeman blue of Astro Security Department. The other two, older, grimmer-faced, were in identical business suits. Pearl-gray cardigan jackets over white turtleneck shirts with sharply creased slacks of charcoal gray. The mid-level executive's uniform, Dan thought sourly. He himself was in faded old coveralls that had once been forest green. Jane was wearing the business suit she had come to Tet Yoroa in, beige slacks, tan jacket, and off-white blouse. "Welcome, Mr. Randolph," said the taller of the two executives. Dan scanned his memory and came up with the man's name. Hubert Peel. Bert stuck out his hand and tried to smile bravely. He was several centimeters taller than Dan, but his gut bulged unheroically. Dan shook hands with him and with the other guy, shorter, balding, his round moon face cut in half by a flowing, luxurious dark mustache. Harold Schmidt, Dan recalled. This is President Scanwell, Dan introduced, the American representative to the Global Economic Council. Madam President will want to arrange transportation back Earthside immediately. Each man shook hands with Jane and mumbled his own name, seemingly embarrassed to meet a former president, and one of the enemy. Then they started toward the conveyor belt people mover that led to the main dome of the Alphonsus complex. I wish you had let us have some advance warning of your arrival, Mr. Randolph. All hell's broken loose here, Bert said. I can imagine. Where's Kate Williams? She went back Earthside a couple days ago, said Harry, scurrying to keep up with the rapid pace Dan was setting. The two security youngsters had taken Jane in hand, literally. Unused to the lunar gravity, she had stumbled and almost fallen. Now the two young men held her arms and helped her along. Dan glanced once over his shoulder and saw that she was in good hands. Then he turned his attention back to his two aides. There's a GEC team on its way here, Bert was explaining. We've already received legal notification that the GEC is taking over control of the entire corporation. Harry said, GEC teams have been hitting every one of our Earthside offices. It's like police raids. Or a hostile takeover, Bert said. Very hostile, said Dan. We were told we're not supposed to have any further dealings with you, Harry added. Not even talk to you. Dan grinned at him. You're not obeying an official GEC order? Shit, boss, you're the guy we work for. Not for much longer, Dan said ruefully. They've got me by the balls. The GEC's really taking over? Harry seemed aghast. But they can't do that. They don't know how to run this operation. Doesn't matter to those double-damned bureaucrats. They've got the law on their side, it looks like. They reached the sliding way and stepped onto it. Still, Dan kept up the rapid pace. Jane and her escorts fell farther behind. What are we going to do? Harry asked.